Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two guests today, first, very soon in fact, we'll hear from the journalist Josh White, who'll talk about renewed interest in Scottish independence after English voters chose to leave the EU. And around the bottom of the hour, the economist Valerie Wilson will report on new evidence that she and a colleague have developed on the racial wage gap. Last June, English voters, and I mean that as distinct from those in Scotland and Northern Ireland, though not Wales, chose to leave the European Union. The legal status of that vote is unclear. The referendum was a political ploy by former Prime Minister and upper-class twit David Cameron, designed to satisfy the far-right wing of his Conservative Party, which has always hated continental Europe and mostly for the wrong reasons. Too cosmopolitan, too decadent, too collectivist. He thought the referendum would lose and the right-wingers would stop bothering him about it. But he miscalculated, and it won. Cameron resigned, reportedly telling aides that he didn't want to have to deal with all the resulting, a word I can't say on the radio. He was succeeded by Theresa May, a veteran Tory politician who's been dealt the hand of dealing with the mess that Cameron created. Although some on the left have embraced Brexit as somehow being a working-class blow against the neoliberal EU, it was largely driven by a narrow English nationalism emerging out of the petty bourgeoisie and parts of the upper middle class. Much of the campaign propaganda of the pro-Brexit forces was xenophobic, directed against Polish immigrants and Syrian refugees, and the atmosphere in the country has only gotten nastier in the 4 months since the referendum. What has not yet happened, though, is any formal declaration of intent to leave the EU, known as triggering Article 50, after the section of the Treaty on European Union covering exit. The British elite would like to craft some way of staying in the Union, even if it doesn't look like that, but the Tory base wants no part of such a scheme, nor does the EU, which wants to make it hard, quite hard, on other members who are contemplating exit. Most analysts are expecting rough waters ahead for the British economy, as Britain loses preferential access to EU markets when it leaves the Union. Foreign investors are likely to leave. One of Britain's selling points was that it's a low-wage platform for frictionless exports to continental Europe, and London's role as a financial capital is likely to be diminished because of a loss of preferred access to European markets. Reflecting these anxieties, the British pound has lost about 15-20% of its value against the US dollar and the euro since the referendum. This is a sign of likely capital flight and will also raise the cost of imports to Britain, which doesn't manufacture a lot of the goods that it consumes. Brexit has also revived talk of Scottish independence. A referendum on secession from the UK failed in a September 2014 vote. That seemed like it, at least for a while. But recently, the leader of the Scottish National Party, Nicola Sturgeon, has introduced the idea of another referendum. She, her party, and most Scots would like to stay in the EU, and they don't want to be dragged out by a bunch of backward-looking English nationalists. Here to sort out the Scottish question and the fallout from Brexit is Josh White, an editor at the webzine Souciant, and author of several articles on that site on these topics. Apologies for the hum in the audio. The interview is plagued by a series of technical annoyances. Josh White. Welcome, Josh. So the leader of the Scottish National Party has been making sounds again about another independence referendum. What's behind this? What do you make of it?
It's clearly a response to Brexit and the political developments of the month since then, especially given developments in the new Conservative government. Some people would say it's a more cynical ploy trying to get extra concessions out of London, such as greater autonomy, maybe a soft Brexit deal, for example, to keep the UK in the single market. That's a big concern for the SNP right now. It's certainly more than that, I think, because the popular base of the SNP is not cynically going for maximum devolution. They want an independent Scotland, and I think that's what ultimately Sturgeon and leadership want.
Was the base surprised by the loss and the referendum?
I think in certain quarters, yes. I think in Glasgow, where there was a nationalist consensus and a great deal of energy behind the independence campaign, I think they were surprised. I think there was a lot of, I wouldn't say disillusionment, but I'd say additional mobilization from the nationalist camp. It seems since then their position has strengthened. I think that's probably going to be even more so the case as we head into Brexit negotiations.
And the Scottish population is largely pro-EU, correct?
Yes. The majority of Scots voted to remain, much like in Northern Ireland.
What's the attraction of the EU? Is this opposition to English nationalism, or is there something about the EU they find attractive?
I think they see it as an alternative structure to get away from the politics of Westminster. They seem to be a lot, the SNP seem to be a lot less sceptical of certain international institutions. For example, they're pro-NATO now, whereas I think that might not be a popular position with the rest of the Scottish people, but it's hard to say. Likewise, they probably look towards Brussels as a alternative to the Union, the British Union, I mean. And until recently, they were considering joining the euro as an alternative to keeping the pound. It's still uncertain where they stand on that question, given the euro crisis.
I was skeptical that Scottish independence would turn out to be a very good thing for the Scots. I thought that they would be under the shadow of British power and also continental European power. And as a small, not very spectacularly rich country with dwindling oil reserves, it would be at the mercy of outside forces. And perhaps the illusions or reality of independence would not be turn out to be as satisfying as the dream of it. What was your thought?
I was skeptical at the time, and I was one of the few people on the English left that was sceptical. I mean, a great deal of people sided with the cause of Scottish independence on radical grounds, usually grounds suspicious of the SNP. My view was that the risk was that an independent Scotland would find itself cut off from the large amount of wealth which is concentrated in southern England. And if you want to wage a distributional struggle within the Union, then it's necessary to remain a part of the United Kingdom. If you become independent, then you simply cut yourself off from that possibility. And I think that for Scottish socialists, it would have been a misstep. I think you could still suggest that there are serious economic problems with independence, but the political situation has shifted in a way which I think is a game changer.
My gut reaction, which is not perhaps very well thought through, but my gut reaction was that after Brexit, I would almost embrace Scottish independence as a way of flipping the bird to the Brexiters. Is there something to that position, do you think?
I think there definitely is. I think Brexit was, although I don't think you can't reduce Brexit to this, it's definitely the case that the Leave vote had a strong nationalist core, which was deeply racist and motivated by trying to seal the borders, take us out of the single market, completely focused on a kind of disordered sense of British history as well. The prospect of Scottish independence would be very much a left-wing intervention into this situation, I think. It would be potentially, for the English left, it would potentially be a great thing, but for the Scottish left, it would embolden them in a serious way. It may mean that the Scottish left would challenge the more conservative elements in the SNP as well, and that would be a great thing.
Yeah, well, what about that SNP? What are those elements?
Well, the history is quite interesting because many of the top brass are former activists. Sturgeon herself started out in the CND campaign to get rid of nuclear weapons in the UK, and Alex Salmond, he was very much opposed to, for example, the NATO bombing of Yugoslavia in the late 90s. And there's a lot of anti-war activists and people who go back to Scottish left-wing parties in the 70s. But today it's a bit different. You have a leadership, and I think probably a majority of the party itself, at least in terms of its parliamentary representatives, who are pro-NATO, for example. And also Salmond's government did business with Donald Trump. They allowed him to carve out a golf course in Aberdeen, for example. And they also fantasized about turning Scotland into a neoliberal kind of Celtic lion modeled on the Irish Celtic tiger.
Because that turned out so well.
Yeah. A lot of that kind of language has been dumped since then, and they now dress themselves up as social democrats or quasi-socialists. And I think that that's more representative of the popular base and probably of a substantial wing of the party itself. But once Scotland becomes independent, then those factions will become much more real, and you could see major infighting or splits, I think.
Now, as you point out in your sociology piece, there's an image of Scotland as a victimized innocent, but it has plenty of history, working with English imperialism and an awful lot of modern capitalist theory came out of Scotland. So it's not exactly the collectivist paradise that it's sometimes presented as.
Exactly. The illusion of Scottish nationalism is to see Scotland in the same light as Ireland, which is very much mistaken if you take a serious look into Scottish history. I mean, for starters, Scotland joined the Union at the beginning of the 18th century because its own experiment with colonialism ended in disaster. I mean, they tried to colonize what is today Panama as part of the Darien scheme, and it all went wrong, and the Scottish nobles who had invested so much in it were bankrupted, effectively. And then they then joined with England to form the British Union. That was an answer for them to essentially get over this crisis of their own empire, really. Well, an attempt at an empire, I should say. That can't be said about Ireland, nor can it be said that the Irish produced a tradition of empirical philosophy, free market economics, and that sort of thing. It's interesting because the basis for Scottish nationalism was probably created partly by the Highland clearances, but also by Irish Catholic immigration. And the counter to that is that you have Protestant Scots settling in Ireland under the English to basically back up the Unionist settlement. So you have Protestant Scots going to Ireland and becoming loyalists, and Irishmen coming to Scotland becoming Scottish nationalists.
That's quite a remarkable history there. I'm speaking with the journalist Josh White, Well, let's talk some about Brexit. There is such a variety of interpretations of that vote, that it was a protest against neoliberalism, a working class revolt. It was a revolt of the somewhat propertied against collectivism. How do you read what the Brexit vote was all about? Who voted for it, and what was its political ideological constituency?
I mean, there's a range of factors, but I think that there is a convenient liberal narrative around this, which has to be questioned. And that narrative points the finger at working class people, and particularly northern working class people, and claims that the vote comes out of the backwardness and ignorance of such a constituency. But really, there was a really sizable part of the vote that came from southern England, and that was petty bourgeois and even upper middle class. There was a strong element of racism and nationalism, as I said before. It's also true that there was a great deal of scepticism from working class people for a range of reasons. I think actually the leading factor was sovereignty. People actually wanted to take back control, but that, of course, is easily conflated with a whole range of xenophobic and more right-wing ideas.
What do they mean by that? Are they talking about Frankfurt bankers or immigrants from Romania?
Well, that's the thing. They get so easily conflated. But I think there's generally a great deal of scepticism towards the EU as a kind of set of laws that are imposing on the country and taking away some degree of independence. And there's also an old hard left analysis of this, that the EU is basically a capitalist racket. And if we break out, we can perhaps pursue more progressive economic policies. I don't think that was the driving factor, but I think it was probably a small part of it.
Yeah, I don't get that argument. It was English voters who gave us Margaret Thatcher and David Cameron, but would not people from Brussels who imposed that on them?
Indeed, yeah, indeed. That's the major flaw in that kind of argument. And it's also the case that Britain does not follow a lot of European legislation, despite it officially being in place. So I think the sovereignty argument is exaggerated. It's also the case that the immigration argument is pretty flawed when you look at the possibilities of curtailing immigration, leaving aside whether or not you think that's a good idea. I seriously doubt this government or any government could actually reduce immigration seriously. It contributes far too much to the economy, for starters. And also the practical aspects of it. They can't police the Irish border. That's just madness.
They could build a wall like Donald Trump, you know?
Some people would like to.
So from a distance, it looks like the aftermath of Brexit has been to emphasize or bring forward the hideous side of it. Lots of xenophobia and immigrant bashing and stuff like that. Is that a fair impression of what life in Britain feels like now?
I think so, yeah, sadly. It's a very strange time in British politics. A lot of the people in the Remain camp, they were caught completely off guard by this. They were very much complacent and thought that it would be very close, but they thought ultimately it would go the right way because people are conservative of small c. They fear very quick change. Generally, that's true, but of British voters, I mean. But still, it's clear that there was a kind of build-up in the run-up to this of nationalist sentiment, I think. And the May government is currently trying to triangulate that sentiment and outmaneuver the threat of UKIP, basically by redefining the centre ground along nationalist terms.
Yeah, May has been making some kind of pro-working class sounds recently, right? What are we to make of that?
Oh, that comes out of the tradition of one nation conservatism. I mean, it may seem quite alien to American listeners, but it goes back to the 19th century over here. It was basically Disraeli's way of keeping the Liberal Party out of office. He expanded suffrage expanded it slightly to working class men. It certainly wasn't universal suffrage. And then he basically appealed to that vote on a nationalist basis. And this is the tradition that May comes from. She's making some noises towards equality of opportunity for working class people. Basically because there's probably a major crisis coming our way, and she has to shore up the base somehow.
Now, I thought Thatcher had snuffed the Tory wets, but they're not dead?
I think it's probably a mistake to read this as Tory wets. It's probable that a lot of this is rhetoric. The only concrete change that we've seen is that they've abandoned austerity as an end in itself. Now, that is very interesting. It just doesn't mean that they're going to suddenly repair all the damage they've done to our public services over the last 6 years.
But she has yet to invoke Article 50, so we're in this limbo where it's not really quite clear what's happening or what's happened or what the future holds, is it?
Yeah, we're in a very strange position. It looks like Article 50 is going to be invoked in March next year, but until then we're still in this strange kind of period of speculation and trepidation, really.
It seems like they would like to have some kind of soft exit or a half exit or a non-exit that appears to be one or some kind of squaring of a circle. But that doesn't really seem in the cards, at least from the EU's point of view.
Yeah, that's right. I think there's a split within the Conservative Party over this that goes back many years. You have a section of the Tory right, or hard right, you might say, that want basically to turn the country completely away from continental Europe, take us out of the single market, seal the borders possibly, and embark on a strange kind of free market fantasy, and take us even further into the US orbit. May, I think, is much more of a realist in this regard and wants a kind of soft Brexit. She wants to keep us in the single market, that's for sure. And that's what probably the majority of the ruling class want, by the way. She's talking up the idea of immigration controls, but she always has done that, if you look at her record. But she's never actually reduced immigration. So I wonder if this is actually just a bargaining chip right now, and that she's making this noise so that it's a way of starting the negotiations. The EU will push for to continue freedom of movement, and then she has a way of her position being talked down, as it were. But, I mean, you could see a major crisis in the Tory party over this.
Who is the social base for that kind of extreme right that you were talking about that wants to close the borders, get out of Europe, get closer to the U.S.? It's not the city or the corporate elite, right? Who are the social base for that?
Much like the Trump phenomenon in the U.S., it's often mistaken for a kind of white working class, raging kind of response to the system as it is, but it's much more petty bourgeois. It's certainly resentful, but I wouldn't exaggerate its working class reach. I mean, the big question for the Tory party is how they shore up their support at this point. They'll have a lot of key supporters, you know, people with mortgages who are fearful of what's going on right now. But at the same time, you have a lot of people in southern England, outside of London, who are kind of traditionalist conservatives and want to get back to some kind of notion of sovereign nationhood, whatever the hell they think that is.
In daily life, do you feel at all the collapse of the pound over the last several weeks, or is that yet to hit prices at the retail level?
I haven't personally felt it, but then again, I haven't been looking that closely. I expect it's hitting a lot of people elsewhere. I mean, certainly people who have transactions overseas, they'll be feeling it. And we're now seeing a little bit of inflation. It's the highest in recent years, but historically I don't think it's that high. The economic situation is quite precarious, increasingly so. People with private pensions have lost thousands of pounds over Brexit.
And you mentioned the crisis within the Tory party, but of course Labour is having its own troubles. What is the contribution of the Brexit vote to Labour's troubles? I mean, Corbyn certainly has been under attack for not having been firmly in the Remain camp or not firmly enough in the Remain camp. But what's happening within Labour now?
Right now, Jeremy Corbyn is trying to consolidate his leadership in a kind of broad church approach by bringing in people from the left, right and the centre into his cabinet, or shadow cabinet. It's wait and see whether that succeeds. I wouldn't exaggerate the extent to which Brexit was a direct cause of the crisis in Labour. I think it was more like an opportunity for the Blairites to launch essentially a coup against the leadership. And they used the soft left in the party, and a candidate called Owen Smith dressed him up with a lot of soft left rhetoric to try and eat into the Corbyn base and undermine him by reducing his majority. In the end, they failed, of course, but it's unclear what they will try next.
So where do you see Britain going? Is the Union going to stay together? Are these two parties, principal parties, going to stay together? Or is just a period of just spinning out of control?
It feels like we are drifting in uncharted territory, so it's very hard to say what could happen next. I wouldn't rule out the Union being dismantled. Scotland would be the first to go. The Welsh nationalists would try to build up some kind of base and reach in order to get a referendum. It might take them a while, but they would probably follow in years or decades to come. The Northern Irish would be the last to go, but that's because of their more complicated history. There's a great threat that the country could move further and further to the right under May if the transition goes the way she wants. But it's also, I don't think that's set in stone. And that's why I think the prospect of Scottish independence could be a good thing. It could knock the British establishment off its feet, as it were, and give the left time to regroup and reassert itself.
That was Josh White, an editor at the webzine Souciant. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
With the bunnies.
That was some of In the Mind of the Bourgeois Reader by Sonic Youth. Next, racial wage gaps. It's an empirical fact that there are large gaps between the average pay of white and non-white workers and between the pay of men and women as well. The reasons for these gaps are complex. Economists have tried to isolate wage discrimination by race or gender by comparing workers who are otherwise similarly situated, education, experience, occupation, region, and the like, and then comparing their incomes. If they're demographically the same, except for race or gender, then that gap can be largely attributed to discrimination. Not all economists accept this, however. Many centrist and conservative ones prefer to cite something called unobserved characteristics, meaning that there's something deficient that employers can see in non-white, non-male workers that justifies their lower pay. This is largely nonsense, of course, but some people have a hard time acknowledging that discrimination exists and that the market isn't a sphere of perfect justice, where one is rewarded in proportion to one's contribution. I should say that those sorts of statistical adjustments, all the measures that try to compare like workers and isolate the effects of pure discrimination, strip away the effects of what are sometimes called pre-market differences. Excluding those factors makes some sense, but they also themselves reflect historical discrimination. We might think of them, in fact, as the inheritance of generations of racism, residential segregation, and with it huge differences in schools and neighborhood amenities, gaps in inherited wealth, and/or sexism, generations of assumptions about the proper role of women. Many of us like to think that racial and sexual discrimination is fading, even if it's still with us. They are not. In fact, they're growing, as our next guest will tell us. Valerie Wilson is the director of the Program on Race, Ethnicity, and the Economy, PRE, at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. Along with William Rogers III, an economist at Rutgers, she's the author of a paper published on the EPI website called Black-White Wage Gaps Expand with Rising Inequality. You can find it at epi.org. Valerie Wilson. I guess most people, or well, maybe I'm crediting the public with a little bit too much knowledge, but many people at least know that there's a substantial gap in incomes and wages between black people and white people in the United States. The reasons for this are complicated, so let's start trying to sort out what those reasons might be. We have, you know, of course, difference in occupation, difference in education, difference in the kinds of neighborhoods one grows up in, but also there's discrimination. How can we sort this all out?
Yeah, so, you know, when we look at average differences in income, there's a lot that's sort of beneath the surface there. Part of it has to do with the fact that when we look at the workforce, the composition of black workers in the workforce is not identical to the composition of white workers. So we have racial differences in levels of education. There are differences in age and experience. There are differences even in terms of how the population is distributed across the country. The majority of African Americans live in the South, where in general incomes, wages are lower because the cost of living is lower. And so all of those factors, you know, play into these average differences. But beyond that, even when we control for each of those factors that, you know, would reasonably affect differences in pay, we still have a stubborn and persistent racial gap in pay. And that part that remains is typically what we identify as the discriminatory component.
Now, economists often refer to these as unobserved characteristics that several or many don't like to leap to the conclusion of then call us discrimination. How do you feel about that?
I tend to think that, you know, I acknowledge that there are factors that we probably don't measure very well or, you know, don't necessarily know how to identify and capture them with concrete measurements in the data. I'm not convinced that if those things have such a large effect on wages that we can't name them. you know, I'm sure there are unobserved or unmeasured factors, but I would still tend to lean on the side that most of that remaining gap is, in fact, discrimination.
I don't like you is kind of hard to quantify, but I guess that factor is there. So, what has happened to these gaps over time? You know, we like to think that race matters less than it used to. Is that true?
Well, you know, that was really the major focus of this paper. I think most people acknowledge the basic fact that there are racial differences in pay. But what we wanted to do was to look at how this has changed or not changed over time. And so, like, the main finding that comes out of the report is that racial wage gaps have actually gotten worse, at least since 1979. And the significance of that period of time is that that was also a period of growing wage inequality overall, and just a broader pattern of wage stagnation that affected workers regardless of their race, ethnicity, or gender. So over that time, the majority of workers haven't seen a lot of wage growth. But the unfortunate part of that is, in that period of time when wages have been stagnant for the majority of workers, those racial differences have actually expanded as opposed to staying the same.
Now, of course, 1979 was a significant year, and that's when Paul Volcker came into the Federal Reserve and tightened money substantially to break inflation. Reagan was inaugurated shortly afterwards and busted the air traffic controllers and began a great redistribution of income upwards. So that was a historical break. But what do we know about wage gaps before 1979?
Well, before 1979, there's evidence that there was some narrowing of racial wage gaps. A lot of that followed from the new laws that were passed in the 1960s as a result of the civil rights movement that helped to provide greater access to African Americans and women, for that matter, to different occupations that they didn't have access to before. There were also, you know, provisions placed in the law that, you know, officially made it illegal to discriminate on the basis of race, ethnicity, gender, and any number of other personal characteristics. And so enforcement of those laws helped to narrow those racial wage disparities during the 1960s and much of the 1970s.
And then we retreated from much of that policy beginning in the 1980s. How does that show up in racial gaps in during that decade?
So I think the evidence of that retreat is especially stark in the data that we looked at. You know, we talk about the overall 36-year trend in these wage gaps getting worse, but the fact is we look at three distinct periods of time, the 1980s, the late 1990s, and then post-2000. And without question, the racial wage gap expanded the most during that 1980s period, where there was an erosion and retrenchment from a lot of those anti-discrimination and affirmative action policies of the 1960s and 1970s.
That was also a period of deunionization, the war on inflation under Volcker and Reagan, that continued. And then the early 90s, the economy was, you know, not really that strong. How did the macroeconomic environment fit into this this story?
So in the early 1990s, things sort of, you know, stayed the same. We didn't really see much change in these racial wage gaps in the early part of the 1990s. The latter part of the 1990s, when we had the economic boom and historically low rates of unemployment that averaged about 4% for a year. During that period, between 1995 and 2000, is when we did see some narrowing of the gap. So that's some evidence there that, you know, tighter labor markets are effective at least having an impact on reducing these racial wage gaps. It didn't eliminate them completely by any means, but there was definitely some narrowing of the gap during that period. And that was the only period of time during this entire 36-year period that we were observing when we saw narrowing of the gap.
And there was also a time when we saw across the board wage and income increases, right? The really sharp decline of the poverty rate, very tight labor markets, real wage gains for just about everybody, regardless of demographic. So that environment helped to narrow the racial wage gap.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. One of the characteristics that really helps to capture the phenomenon of growing wage inequality and wage stagnation is to look at what happened with median hourly wages relative to productivity growth. And so prior to 1979, you know, for the most part, when productivity was rising, workers' wages were rising, you know, pretty consistently, pretty close to the rate of productivity growth. That stopped happening in 1979. However, for that brief five-year period in the late 1990s, we again saw workers' wages rising at a rate that was close to the rate of productivity growth. So that is very important in terms of raising living standards for workers across the board, but also for narrowing these racial disparities in pay.
And now we've got very weak productivity growth, okay wage growth, but nothing spectacular. What affected the Great Recession and this rather weak recovery from it have on racial wage gaps?
So since 2000, we've seen the gaps continue to expand, not nearly as dramatically as we saw during the 1980s, but there clearly has been some expansion of the gap. I think one of the things that's unique when we look at the post-2000 period is that you see the pattern being very different for different groups of workers. So, for example, when we studied these racial wage gaps, we looked at racial wage gaps between black and white men, between black and white women. We looked at workers who were new entrants to the workforce, meaning they had between 0 and 10 years of experience, as well as workers who had 11 to 20 years of experience. And so in this post-2000 period, really the group for whom these racial wage gaps have grown the most are young African-American women. So African-American women who are those 0 to 10 years of experience or newly out of school. That's the group who has seen the worst expansion of the wage gaps since 2000.
Now, of course, when you talk about wage stagnation in general, you know, or more specifically by demographic group, the answer always is coming from the mainstream pundits: education. More people in college, and you know, more education will cure many of these problems. Do you find much evidence for that?
You know, our evidence really sort of contradicts that idea. But I think there's a distinction, important distinction, to be made concerning education. Education, without a doubt, boost one's mobility. In other words, it's clearly effective at increasing your chances of finding a job and increasing the level of pay that you will receive on that job. What it is less effective at doing is narrowing or eliminating those racial wage disparities. So a black college grad will without a doubt make more than people who don't have a college degree. But they don't necessarily make the same amount as a white college grad. And so that's what's challenging in the data. And beyond that, we've found that the wage gaps among college educated workers has actually grown more over this period than it has for those with less than a college degree.
Why might that be?
Well, I think there are a number of factors there. I think one of the challenges in looking at what's happening with college-educated workers is that it goes back to sort of these broader wage inequality trends. We know that to the extent that wages have grown, most of that growth has gone to those at the top of the wage distribution, which would disproportionately be people with, you know, a college degree or more. However, most of that wage growth has gone to those in the top 1% or higher. And among that group of workers, you're going to find very few African Americans. So I think this trend of growing wage inequality with the concentrated wage growth being at the very top of the wage distribution is really what we are pulling out of looking at this growing disparity in wages for college graduates.
I'm speaking with Valerie Wilson of the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. You look at the wage gap in two major ways. One is just the raw numbers, but also then you adjust for experience and geography and industry and education and that sort of thing. What does that process of adjustment, how does that change the story?
Well, the process of adjustment, you know, pulls out those differences in the composition of workers that, you know, would rationally and reasonably affect what different workers are paid. So we find that when we control for education, experience, region of the country, whether or not a worker lives in a metropolitan area, being, you know, an urban area or a rural area, we do find that narrows the gap. So, for example, for men, we find that in 2015, the unadjusted gap, or just the average difference in pay between white males and black males, is about 31%. But when we adjust for those other factors, we get a gap of about 22%.
So that 22%, the proverbial unobserved characteristics, one would conclude, were one so inclined, that that's largely discrimination.
Right. A large part of that remaining part of the gap, I would attribute to racial discrimination.
That's very, very large. I mean, when I read a lot of these literature about 10, 15 years ago, I recall the numbers were more like around 10%. So has this grown over time?
Yes, that absolutely has grown. You know, which is another feature or major finding from our report is that these wage gaps have grown. Also, another part of that in looking at these racial wage differences separately for men and for women, we find that although for women these wage gaps, the racial part of the wage gap at least, tends to be smaller than it is among men, the gap, racial wage gap among women has actually grown more than it has among men. So a lot of the overall or average increase that we would measure in the black-white wage gap as a whole comes from this growing racial wage disparity among women.
How do these things work together? You know, black women, of course, face both gender and racial discrimination. What are the relative contributions of those two vectors?
So for African-American women, without question, the largest disadvantage is the gender disadvantage. That part of the gap, so if we compare African-American women to white men, again, using the latest year available, 2015 data, we find that African-American women earn about 34% less than white men. Compared to, when we look at just the racial component of the gap, the difference is about 12% between white women and black women. So there's more of a wage disadvantage associated with gender for African-American women than there is associated with race. However, that being said, we've seen declining gender wage gaps over this period from 1979 to 2015, while at the same time there have been growing racial wage gaps. So on one hand, African-American women are benefiting from the narrowing of the gender wage gap, but still being disadvantaged by a growing racial wage gap.
And then how does geography figure into this? You look at region, but also metro versus non-metro. How does geography affect these gaps?
Well, the geographic findings were really interesting as well, because what we find is that in 1979, there were clear differences across regions of the country when it comes to the size of the racial wage gap. In 1979, the South clearly had the largest racial wage disparities. Other regions of the country had lower racial wage disparities. The Midwest had the lowest. However, fast forward to 2015, and the difference across regions in the size of that gap is nearly indistinguishable. So in 2015, regardless of where you live in the country, for men, the size of that gap is right around 20% or 22%. And among women, we see a range of about 9% to 11%. So what that says is that at some point, at least during the early 1980s and 1970s, there were opportunities for African Americans who chose to relocate to different parts of the country outside of the South and really increase their chances of receiving fairer pay. Since that period, those opportunities have dwindled or narrowed considerably.
And any sense of why that happened?
Well, I think a part of it has to do with really worsening of the wage gaps in regions outside of the South. So we haven't seen a huge change in the size of black-white wage gaps within the South. But what we have seen is that those gaps have worsened considerably in the other regions of the country, so in the Midwest, the Northeast, and even the West. The Midwest probably tells the clearest story as to why that has been the case when we consider the factors associated with declining unionization. We know that manufacturing sector in that region of the country suffered a hit during this period of time. And so that really gives us a much clearer picture of why things got worse for African Americans relative to whites in the Midwest, compared to what we saw or what we've seen in the South.
We know that unions tend to soften the effects of discrimination on women and non-white people. What was the contribution of the erosion in the unionization rate been to the racial gap?
So that was another thing that we looked at here. We wanted to see specifically what effect declining unionization has had in the expansion of this gap. And again, most of that impact happened during the 1980s when there, you know, was there's still a clear and concerted effort to weaken unions, but that's when, you know, we really saw the biggest hit against unions across the country, and, you know, in sizable unions. You mentioned air traffic controllers. And so that accounts for a significant part of the expansion of the wage gap. Most of that was concentrated in that 1980s period, and the effect is largest among men, particularly younger men, that new entrant or 0 to 10 years of experience group.
Now, I believe you said that you were somewhat surprised by the results. I think the consensus among economists and people who watch the economy was that these gaps were either steady or, if anything, narrowing, but obviously you find them widening. Was this surprising to you?
I don't know that the broader picture of widening wage gaps was surprising to me necessarily, as much as the groups within our study. Clearly the largest expansion among college graduates was surprising to me, that would be the group who was seeing the worst expansion of wage gaps. But I think there's, you know, the perception, and the reason why we really haven't seen a lot of studies on racial wage gaps since about the mid late 1990s is that, you know, we've assumed that since, you know, wages have been fairly stagnant or flat really since 2000, that, you know, these wage gaps must be the same too, because everyone's wages haven't gone anywhere. So I would say that probably was a bit of a surprise, to actually see a growing racial wage gap during this period when it's well documented that wages have been fairly flat. And what that means essentially is that although the average has been flat, for African Americans, these wages, real wages, have actually been declining.
And I always ask this sort of question when we only have 2 minutes left, but we have those last 2 minutes. What can we do about this?
What can we do about this? So I think it's important when we want to address these racial wage disparities to come at it from two directions. Because there's the issue of addressing the racial difference in pay, but then there's also the issue of raising wages in general. You know, on one hand, we could focus on reducing the racial differences in pay, but if we continue along the path of stagnant wages, that only gets you so far, really. So we really need to address both the racial component, and that having to do with the discriminatory factors that are affected by enforcing anti-discrimination laws, and, you know, really having some focused study and discussion behind some of these quote-unquote unobservable factors that could be affecting wage gaps. But on the other side of things, I'd like to see a Federal Reserve pursuing monetary policy that really targets full employment and wage growth that matches productivity gains. That's something that would benefit all workers. It's a race-neutral policy, so to speak, but it would have disproportionate benefits for African-American workers.
And is there some sort of data that we don't have that you would like to see collected?
Well, one of the other questions that kept coming up in doing this research is we know that during this period of time we also had the trend of mass incarceration, particularly during the 1990s. And so the question has been, you know, what effect has that played in these measured differences? Because disproportionately, African-American men with a high school education or less were affected by that trend. That would have the effect of pulling out a significant number of these men from the workforce, and, you know, hence they're not captured or measured in the wage data. So, you know, I'd like to be able to see data where we could sort of account for that trend in mass incarceration, both in the 1990s when people were pulled out of the workforce and since then when we've had people returning to the workforce, to see sort of what effect that has had on these measured differences between black and white workers.
And, of course, mass incarceration affects not only the individuals who get thrown in jail, but also communities and families.
Yes, absolutely.
That was Valerie Wilson, director of the Program on Race, Ethnicity, and the Economy at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. She is the co-author, along with William Rogers III, of Black-White Wage Gaps Expand with Rising Inequality, a paper you can find on the EPI website at epi.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of Leadbelly's Bourgeois Blues. Till next week, bye.
Down. I got a bourgeois blues, gonna spread it.